Today's Teisho will be on Case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Case 37 is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. Introduction. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who can administer the poison? Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly says all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I tell him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is there active consciousness, boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. So thank you all very much for doing such an excellent job. This is day two of our session, and everybody has been sitting so deeply. It's really wonderful. It's a great pleasure to practice with people who practice so wholeheartedly. It's demanding schedule, but everybody is obviously putting in 100%. So thank you so much. This koan is entitled Guishan's Active Consciousness. And we are all getting in touch with our active consciousness at this session. In fact, it's actually pretty difficult, unless you've been practicing for a long time, to get in touch with your active consciousness in your daily life, at least at first. Even though it's always there, as I will have more to say, being able to be, we should say, aware of it or open to it, takes a lot of sitting. This is not necessarily something people want to hear. In the introduction, the koan says, driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who could administer such poison? One way of understanding those lines is to say that we don't necessarily want to hear what this koan has to say. And that's often the case, right? I mean, sometimes the thing we most need to hear or the thing that would most help us is what we least want to hear. So in this case, it's compared to a poison, right? I mean, it's not really a poison, it's actually medicine. But the koan is compared to a poison because probably initially people might not like what the koan has to say. Yesterday, I had to go to the store again because I forgot to get some cabbage. I was planning on the night of our arrival to serve cabbage for lunch today, and we're going to have cabbage for lunch. But I forgot to buy it on Tuesday night when we arrived. So I went back yesterday to the grocery store, and I was waiting in line, and sometimes if there's a long line in the grocery line, I look for Prevention Magazine. I don't know if you've ever seen Prevention Magazine, but it's a little magazine that has lots of health tips. So they have fascinating articles on vitamin A and things like that. And if you're interested in health, it's a way of killing time until you can start getting your groceries processed. So I was looking around for a prevention magazine, and I noticed a magazine, and I didn't really have a chance to look at it because it was my turn to, you know, get my groceries onto the conveyor belt. But the magazine was like, it was one of these fashion magazines or something like that, and it had it in big yellow letters at the bottom of the page. It said mindfulness tips, you know. Mindfulness tips or it could have been Esquire or something, I don't know. But the point is, and mindfulness is really very popular, right? I mean, a few years ago, Time magazine had a whole front page story on mindfulness, you know, and you know, it's really everywhere. Mindfulness, and if you go to everywhere you go, people are selling mindfulness, basically, and it's possible to take mindfulness classes everywhere. You know, at the university, the Psychological Services runs a lunchtime mindfulness class, you know, and, you know, if you study the history of mindfulness meditation in Buddhism, it's actually quite interesting and actually quite complicated, you know. So what's called Vipassana meditation is really worthy of great respect and has many aspects that are similar to Zen, as a matter of fact, although they don't use koans. Vipassana is really just one part of a meditation practice. Even in the Vipassana tradition, they know that meditation involves two aspects, you could say. One is shamatha, which is basically calming or stabilizing the mind. And the other is vipassana, or observing. So basically, when we start watching the breath, we're observing, we're practicing mindfulness. And at the same time, we're also stabilizing the mind and quieting the mind. And one way to think about mushin or deep samadhi is that it's a very radically deep form of shamatha, although it has a vipassana element too. And then, you know, when you can enter deep mushin, the teacher might give you a koan that requires you to be alert to something that you don't quite know in the moment. And maybe you wind up listening very carefully to sounds. Maybe the koan is something like, why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? And maybe you start listening to sounds. So in that case, you're practicing shamatha and vipassana at the same time. You're entering deep mushin, and then you're observing the world around you in some way, or your own mental processing in some way. Zen adds another dimension to this, but they're very similar in some ways. So I'm not criticizing vipassana meditation itself. But I do want to say that, shamatha meditation and vipassana meditation together are a wonderful process, but it's not what is being sold in the grocery stores in the magazine rack, you know. When mindfulness is being sold, it's really just sort of like being aware or paying attention, right? And so people are just being aware and paying attention, and this works very well if you think of your mind as a kind of machine that you can improve the functioning of your, you can uh, Think of the mind as a machine which you can improve, right? And you can improve the functioning of your machine. So, you know, basically, if you want to be more efficient on your job, mindfulness. You know, if you want to be better at this, mindfulness. You know, so you're thinking about your mind as something that's like a machine. It's, you know, if I want to go to the store, I jump in my car and I drive to the store. I turn the car on. I expect it to work. When I turn right, the car should turn right. When I turn left, the car should turn left. You know, when I turn it off, I don't wake up at night and think, you know, how's my car doing? I hope it's warm, you know. It's a machine, right? It's supposed to take me somewhere. Just before the session, I took it into my car guys and they changed the oil and checked it out so it wouldn't break down on the Garden State Parkway. And people kind of think of themselves as machines too, you know. So I want to improve my efficiency. I want to be more efficient on the job. I'll try mindfulness, right? And maybe I'll be able to process more information, you know, and so on. I hope I'm making some sense. But it's a very simple-minded view or simplistic view of the mind, you know. And it's not really a very accurate understanding of how our mind works. Our mind isn't a machine, and we're not the driver of the machine. So, you know, you're not driving your mind around the way you would drive your car around. And, you know, I might put in a different kind of gas to get better mileage, and mindfulness is kind of like gas I'm putting into my mind to improve its mileage or something. You know, the way we Zen people look at the mind is a little bit more complicated. You know, the truth is that there's a lot of ourselves that we don't know. You know, there's a lot of ourselves we don't know. And we may never know a lot of things about ourselves, you know, because much of our mental processing takes place below the level of our conscious awareness. And this is actually a very interesting, you know, we've all grown up maybe hearing about Freud and his discoveries. We all know what the unconscious is, you know. But you know, actually, the unconscious means that inside of you is a person you don't fully understand and a person you don't really control. And that's an interesting claim, right? That inside you, there's a person you don't really know and a person you can't control. Freud, you know, the Viennese founder of psychiatry, you know, discovered this because he would have all these patients who were doing things that they didn't want to do, but they were doing them compulsively. So, you know, somebody might be a very rational philosophy professor, but he would occasionally find himself sticking his hand into the fire, you know, something like that. Freud would say, "Did you want to stick your hand in the fire?" And the guy would say, "Well, no, but I've had to do it. Somehow I just had to stick my hand in the fire," right? So, you know, Freud said, this is a compulsion. You know, something inside this guy that he doesn't understand is telling him to do something. In this case, harming himself, actually, right? Freud studied a lot of other cases like this, where people were, their rational mind would tell them one thing, but they would do something else, or they would feel something else. So we all have this experience sometime. You know, maybe in your life you've gone through a period of unhappiness or the blues, you know. And sometimes people will try to cheer you up by saying something like this, you know, why are you unhappy? You have everything. Look, you know, you have a nice house, you have a good job, you know, you have a car that doesn't break down on the Garden State Parkway. You should be happy, right? You know, and the person might say, I don't know why, but I'm really unhappy, see? And that's so interesting. And, you know, if you think, well, you know, we are just the conscious mind, the small mind, as we say in Zen, then you shouldn't be happy. I should be able to argue you out of your unhappiness by showing you that all the reasons for being happy are false, right? But that never works. It never works. It's like a few years ago, a person in the Korean department, a woman in the Korean department, her son got hit by a car and killed at a charity bike-a-thon. And she asked to meet with me in my capacity as a Zen teacher. And she's from a Korean background and a Buddhist background. And, you know, she wanted me to tell her something that would make the pain go away, right? And I could have said, well, you know, he's in heaven, you know, he'll be reborn as a, you know, very intelligent and generous person or something like that. And anything that I could have told her would have been ineffectual, right? Because she's feeling these deep thoughts, these deep feelings of loss on another level. So you know, basically, humans are not, the mind is not like a machine we drive around in. And, you know, behind our eyes, there isn't a little person who's giving, you know, pulling the levers and stepping on the gas, you know. That's not how the mind really works. You know, there's a conscious mind, which is like the tip of this big iceberg, you know, but deep inside of us is a stranger that we don't usually know much about, or we don't always know much about, and whom we don't control. And this is a really important fact about ourselves that a lot of people don't like. You know, I know a lot of people who are very, you know, they really, you know, they, even though therapy has become fairly widespread in our culture, you know, there's still a lot of people who will say, you know, and when I was growing up, people used to refer to psychiatrists as head shrinkers. That, you know, in the Melanesian islands, they used to take kill people and shrink their heads down and wear them as trophies, and so psychiatrists were referred to humorously as head shrinkers. And then you'd go to your psychiatrist, he was a shrink. In other words, people were very afraid of psychiatrists. And they called them shrinks because it was like they were like witch doctors, right? Witch doctors. So there was a lot of fear about the idea that inside ourselves there is a stranger. We don't really know that person, and we don't really control that person. And you know, in the world of mindfulness, that doesn't exist, right? That just doesn't exist. But you know, Zen is all about getting in touch with that stranger, you know, and you know, if people get depressed, they might have a good job, they might have a good marriage, they might have, you know, they can go to like a therapist and talk about, you know, their feelings, and they may begin to get a little bit of a glimpse of that person inside themselves, right? And that's a good thing, you know. In Zen, we do this a little differently, you know. And we have a little different view of the stranger inside ourselves, you know. You know, basically, we believe that, you know, there's, just like Freud, we believe that there's a lot of stuff in there that gets in our way, stuff that causes us a lot of suffering, and that we have to work through all those obstacles to be a happier, more awake person, right? More generous person. We believe, unlike Dr. Freud, that, you know, at the core of our consciousness is enlightened mind. You know, so if you think about the human being, you know, the human being is an enlightened mind that has in its life experiences that create obstacles. And the truth is, society doesn't necessarily want enlightened beings. That's a kind of a strange thing to say, but, you know, society is a little bit uneasy with an enlightened person. When Bodhidharma went to China and he met Emperor Wu of Liang, you know, Bodhidharma was not a typical person. You know, he was introduced to the emperor, and instead of trying to curry favor with the emperor, instead of trying to impress the emperor or win the emperor's favor, he was very brusque. He wasn't rude, but he clearly wasn't interested in trying to impress the emperor of that part of China. And the emperor asked him a few questions, and when Bodhidharma could see that the emperor wasn't understanding him, he just said goodbye and he left. And that was the end of the interview. There was a, so sometimes, you know, society doesn't necessarily want you to be a fully awake person. You know, if you're a fully awake person, you might not do what you're supposed to do. See? So for example, in traditional societies, women are supposed to be obedient to their fathers and to their husbands. And they're not supposed to pursue maybe their own interests. You know, so my mother wanted to become a lawyer, and my grandfather wouldn't have spent any money on really a daughter's education. You know, so my mother actually never did become a lawyer. She did become a very capable court reporter and loved the law. But, you know, society didn't want my mother to be a lawyer. And, you know, she had a lot of creative energy and intelligence and motivation that society didn't allow her to express, you know. So you know, it's true that also society doesn't necessarily want enlightened people. So, you know, inside of us, there's an enlightened person trying to get out, you know. And there are certain kinds of blockages that we create, and there are certain kinds of blockages that society creates, you know. When we are living in the world as our conscious selves, you know, we're seeing pretty much only what society has wanted us to see, or what the accidents in our life have allowed us to see, you know. So, there are many stories about, say, people who... parents want I have friends who have pushed their children to become doctors and so on, and they've become doctors and they're not very happy as doctors, and they've studied anthropology and become anthropologists, medical anthropologists. I have a friend like that. And, you know, his parents just wanted him to be a doctor. He was unhappy as a doctor. And, you know, somebody could say, what are you talking about? You're a doctor. You know, you've got everything going for you. You make a nice income. You know, everybody respects you. You get to wear a white jacket all day. But he was unhappy, and he went back to graduate school, and he studied anthropology. And his parents said, what are you doing? You're throwing your medical degree away. So, you know, he actually, something inside him, said, I've done what society expects, but I don't want to be a doctor. And you know, so you know, society's telling us all kinds of things. And it's also often not encouraging us to trust ourselves, right? So you know, our situation in reality is not that kind of, it's not what we see in the magazine in its little blurb on mindfulness, right? How to improve your functionality at work. It's really about getting to know that stranger and beginning to liberate that stranger in yourself. And there's a lot of obstacles in the way of that liberation. Some of them are society, some of them are your life experience, and some are just your own hesitation about, you know, it's difficult to go into a place you don't understand. You know, when we do meditation, we go into a dark place, right? We go into mushin, into a blank place. And, you know, for some people, that's actually a little frightening or a little bit unnerving at first. So you go into that emptiness and you have to stay with that emptiness before anything can happen. You know, that empty place is the door between you and your big mind, your unconscious mind. And it takes a while for people to get there. And, you know, sometimes they have a lot of obstacles that prevent them from getting there very easily. But eventually, most people who practice, most people who come to sesshins will be able to get to mushin sooner or later. And then a lot of Zen practice is learning how to just sit in front of that blank wall and allow the process of the koan to open you up. And this is a little risky because, you know, we have been encouraged not to believe there is anything behind that blank wall. It's easy to think we have control over our lives, right? In fact, it's preferable to think we have control over our lives. Now, when I was in school, this is, I'm sure they don't do this anymore, but we used to recite a poem, and one of the lines was, I am the captain of my soul and the master of my fate, right? You know, from a Zen standpoint, that's like crazy, right? You know, a better way to put it would be to say we have Buddha nature inside ourselves, and we don't really know always who we are and what we're supposed to do. So, you know, a lot of Zen practice is sitting on the cushion until you can enter that blankness, and then waiting for that blankness to, something to present itself out of that blankness. And that's a wonderful, wonderful situation for people. Because, you know, you have to develop a very different kind of personality. If you are the kind of person who likes to think of yourself in charge, it's going to be very frustrating. You know, there have been a number of people who have come to sesshin and left actually really pretty pissed off, you know. And part of it is that they really, really have fantasies. They feel the deep need to control things, right? You know, I really need to be able to be in control. There was a guy who doesn't sit with us anymore, but he used to sit when he was at Rutgers in college. And he met me at a time in his life when he was very unhappy. He was the valedictorian at Rutgers, by the way. And he was, he came into the Zendo one time early on. He found our group. He came in a little early and he just started sobbing, you know. And, you know, later it turned out that his father had been physically abusive to him. He did Zazen, but it was very hard. It was always very hard for him to do Zazen. And the whole time we were working together, and he practiced for like 6 or 7 years. You know, the whole time we were doing Zazen, he was also, he went from being a rather normal person physically to becoming like what my mother used to call a muscle man, right? So he became very, very muscular, right? And I could see that he was going to the gym a lot, and he was bulking up, as they say. And he developed sort of like a fat neck. I hope he wasn't taking steroids, you know. It was interesting to see this physical transformation of somebody who had been, you know, sort of a moderately well-built young man to a muscle man. And I think it was very difficult for him, even though he stayed with Zen for a long time, very difficult for him to sit down on the cushion and face that emptiness, because that meant he had to be, had to let go of control, right? And I think because he was physically abused as a child, letting go of control was a frightening situation for him, you know? I think that it was frightening because he felt maybe he was making himself vulnerable to attack, you know? So, you know, Zen definitely did help him a lot. He eventually married a very lovely young woman. And, you know, I think he's a very loving and compassionate father. I'm sure he doesn't hurt his son, you know, I'm sure of it. And he's benefited a lot from Zen, but, you know, I think he found that situation very difficult. You know, sitting for him was a challenge. And, you know, if you can go to the gym and lift hundreds of pounds, you know, you're not a stranger to physical pain, right? I mean, usually you are working at your, when you get bulked like that, you're pushing your muscles to the point where they're hurting the whole time you're working. I think what was, he often said his legs hurt, but I think what really hurt was giving up control. So when you're facing that blank wall, you know, you have to be able to be out of control. You have to be able to be in the dark, right? I love that, being in the dark. You know, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, and I can't control the situation. That's where all good things come from, you know, basically. You have to live on trust. You have to live on trust. We all live on trust, whether we know it or not, you know. I got in my car and I drove down here. My car has got 160,000 miles on it. You know, it's living on trust, you know. Right now, a friend of mine, a guy who was in our group for a long time, has terminal cancer. And he may not make it through the session, you know. We all get up every day and go through our lives and we hope we don't have terminal cancer. You know, how long we live, you know, is impossible to say, you know. We really don't control much, you know. I mean, we live on trust much more than we care to think. And so, you know, being in a situation on the cushion where you have to trust that blankness is so good. Because when you stop trying to control things, you begin to connect more deeply with everything around you. And you can begin to connect more deeply with your big mind. A lot of Zen practice is just sitting in darkness waiting for something to happen. At first, you know, when you face that blankness, it may seem like nothing is happening. Right, so there's a long phase of meditation practice on that emptiness or mu, where, you know, you're just sitting waiting for something to happen. And people have different reactions to this. Some people, like the person I just talked about, the muscle man, you know, was uncomfortable giving up control because of injuries that he'd had as a child. You know, other people, blame themselves. People, you know, go through a lot of negativity on the cushion. You know, I'll never be able to do this. I knew I wouldn't be able to answer my koans and so on. Or some people are very results-oriented, you know, so they try to pressure themselves into getting the right answer or something like that. But you really just have to sit with that blankness, quietly waiting, and what seems like, can seem like a dead blankness begins to come to life. And this is our relationship in Zen with our true nature, right? You know, we sit in front of that blankness and we learn how to be patient and trusting. And this is our relationship with the stranger inside of us, right? So if you learn nothing else from Zen practice, you learn how to be patient and trusting in the presence of uncertainty. You know, and if nothing else happens, you know, on the cushion, we can talk about enlightenment, we can talk about Kensho, but those things alone are enormous gifts, right? And in our modern world, we don't necessarily understand how important those are. You know, if you think about our ancestors, you know, if you think about like a farmer, I just think it's astonishing, right? You know, people would actually plant seeds in the ground and spend weeks doing it. You know, if you have to plow the soil, you have to plow the soil, and then you plant seeds, and then you just hope it rains, right? And that's your life. Right? It's like if the rains don't come, you're in big trouble. You know, imagine people who live that way, right? You know, basically you put these seeds in the ground and then you just hope it rains. And if it doesn't rain, you might not live, right? I mean, our ancestors understood how to be patient and how to trust, because that's all you can do ultimately, right? So, Zen practice, you learn how to be trusting and patient, facing that blankness. And at first, what seems like a dead blankness can begin to come to life, and this is a deeply transformative situation. You know, this is the kind of the situation where, basically we become different people. And it's liberating, actually, to be frustrated in this way. You know, we want to make something happen. We want to answer the koan. We want to be able to, you know, the ideal thing is to be given a koan, to sit down with the koan, to focus on it, to be mindful, right? And say, you know, one hand clapping, one hand clapping, one hand clapping. You know, you want to go into the teacher and go, here's the answer, blah, blah, blah. And then the teacher goes, oh, that's fantastic, you know. But, you know, none of those things happen, it's sort of like so discouraging or so frustrating or so angering. But, you know, as far as becoming an awakened person goes, this is the ideal situation. Because it's like, you know, you go through all of these different mental states. Some of them are like heavenly and some of them are hellish, right? But you realize, you know, basically, fundamentally, none of these are who you really are. And this is so liberating. You know, at some point, you know, when I was working with koans, you know, I would get so frustrated and discouraged and angry at myself, right? And I realized, you know, I don't have to do this. You know, at some point, For the millionth time, I was angry and discouraged and beating myself up. And I realized I've been doing this to myself since I was like in the sixth grade. You know, every time I wouldn't get good grades, I would punish myself psychologically. You know, it's okay not to know. It's okay. That emptiness is a space of wonderful possibility. And it's so liberating to put away all one's identities and habits and just be present. You know, so I don't have to be angry at myself right now. You know, I don't have to be frustrated. That's just a game I'm playing. You know, so you know, being in front of that wall can be very liberating, because it's showing us the artificiality of our routines, our mental routines. You know, you might have to go through them 20 or 30 more times to see how artificial and unreal they really are. But when you do, it's just so liberating. You know, why am I always measuring myself against some ideal standard? You know, why am I doing that to myself? I don't have to. I can just be present with this darkness. You know, and suddenly everything around you comes to life and is so beautiful. So this koan is really about our relationship with our big mind, as we say, with that unconscious mind that is, you know, from the Zen standpoint, we believe wiser than we are. And it's true that there are these obstacles in there that we have to work through, but every time you work through an obstacle, you get a little glimpse of enlightened mind. And gradually, little by little, you know, you are getting closer and closer to that radiant core of the mind. And, you know, this usually involves some effort. You know, even though you can't control it, you have to try. You have to sit with the koan, and you that will create a kind of internal pressure or tension. That will. So it's definitely the case that even though you're out of control, and even though you're you don't know what you're doing, you have to make the effort. You have to try to answer the question. This is called in Zen the doubt. It's called the doubt sensation. If you read books on Zen, it says you have to cultivate the doubt sensation. But that's actually a terrible translation. You have to want to know the answer to your koan. So you know, as you're working with Mu or as you're working with your koan, you may find that there's a kind of pressure, internal pressure or energy that builds up. And this is actually a good thing, good sign. You want to just let the pressure blow your head off, you know, basically. So keep pressing into the koan, and something will reveal itself to you. Guishan's active consciousness. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who can administer the poison? So, in other words, the magazine, next time, you know, somebody who understood Zen could, where it says something like mindfulness, exclamation point, it would say, you're not in control, exclamation point. Or smiley face, right? Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him. I say, hey, you. If the monk turns his head, I said, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have nothing fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. So What he's really saying is, even when we think we're in control, we're not really in control. You know, even when we think we're in control, we're not really in control. And that's good, not bad. Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self? Do you know you're the stranger in yourself or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that, seeing your enlightened nature through the, like the ivy of your obstacles. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless ocean of destitution, has such sorrow. So, that's not to be taken literally, right? I mean, when you lose your riches, when you lose your control, you know, everything becomes possible. So yeah, maybe at first we have sorrow, but eventually this is the road to happiness, right?